Good morning and welcome to the final convocation of the current academic year. The Roman poet Horace advised authors with these words, "Follow tradition, or if you invent, see that your characters be congruent." I'm happy to introduce today an author who, in his historical novels, has been following that advice in his own special way. Dr. Paul L. Meyer is our speaker this morning. Dr. Meyer is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University and campus chaplain to the Lutheran students there. He's no stranger, of course, to this campus, being an erstwhile resident not too far from here and also a 1955 graduate of the seminary. In addition, he has an MA from Harvard University and a PhD from the University of Basel in Switzerland. Many of you, no doubt, have read some or all of his earlier historical novels, Pontius Pilate, The First Christmas, First Easter, The First Christians, and more recently, The Flames of Rome. He informs me he is also a co-editor on a currently appearing commentary on Josephus. Also especially precious to us in these circles are his biography of his father, Dr. Walter A. Meyer, A Man Spoke, A World Listened, and the anthology of his father's writings, The Best of Walter A. Meyer. Dr. Meyer's topic today is the Greco-Roman perspective in biblical studies, and in the face of the tide of recent biblical studies from the perspective of Judaica, I am sure you agree with me that it is important for us to hear what applications to the New Testament are made by a classicist and a historian of the Roman age. So therefore, join me in welcoming and in paying eager attention to Dr. Paul Meyer.
Thank you. Gee, you really make a person feel at home here. Boy, talk about a homecoming. This is a double homecoming for me because not only did I graduate in the great class of 1955 along with Manny Jansen and others, but I grew up on this campus in North Seminary Terrace. The first 20 years of my life were spent here, so this is truly a homecoming. And I went to chapel this morning, and I was really delighted to see these fellows line up. I was afraid it was an excommunication ceremony, but that wouldn't have been too appropriate. I could spend the next hour alone regaling you about Concordia Seminary in times yore, about what, you know, coming of age at Concordia was like, and what the students thought of us in those days, profs, kids, something like the 11th plague of Egypt, after the boils and the hail and the darkness came the prof's kids. We were less reverent in those days. Dr. Walter's first seminary there used to have a bell tower next to it, but they took it down primarily because we were ringing the bell at all hours of the night, usually 2 or 3 in the morning. When we say we know this campus from the bottom up, we mean quite literally, because one of the prof's kids got a hold of a pass key and we used the steam tunnels underneath this complex of buildings to infest the place years ago, especially when we would torment the students or set off skyrockets in the quadrangle during final examinations. I hope there are no prof's kids present so we don't give many ideas, but we were an unregenerate crew back in those days, we really were. Forgive us the sins of our youth. This morning, then, I had breakfast over here, and I eagerly looked to see if grape nuts were available, and they were not. And I'll tell you why. This is according to the really historical, critical tradition here. We'll tell you why there are no grape nuts. Because of the great grape nuts caper in 1936. That's why. Walt, my brother, and I... Now, I don't want to justify Walt at this point. He can handle... I'm not sure I could speak objectively on the issue. Anyway, Walt and I went over to the chief dietitian at the seminary. Her name was Ma Powers. And in 1936, the CW Post Company of Battle Creek, Michigan, came across with a great grape nuts offer, whereby if you had enough grape nuts tops, you could buy catcher's mitt, tennis racket, microscope, chemistry set, and all these good things. Usually the combination was 4 grape nuts flakes box tops and $3 for the catcher's mitt, or 20, you know, box tops. Always that option of letting it all be box tops. So we went over to the chief dietitian, and we told her about the value, vitamins and otherwise, included in grape nuts. And for the next 8 weeks, the only breakfast cereal allowed was grape nuts. We got all the box tops, and we sent hundreds of them to Battle Creek. And every 3 weeks, we got this cargo of goodies. Tennis rackets for everybody on the block, baseball mitts, catchers, and so forth. And that's the reason that you folks have since been phased out of grape nuts. Back in those days, there were two very famous Karl Barths in the world. One was much less famous as far as we were concerned. He was a rather insignificant Swiss theologian writing things like Raymer Brief and that kind of thing. The Karl Barth we knew, of course, was the tennis ace out in the tennis courts there. And since then, he's gone on to other things, I understand. The Greco-Roman perspective in biblical studies should actually, apologies to John here, be entitled the Greco-Roman Judaic Hellenistic perspective to biblical studies, or to put it much more briefly, the extra-biblical approach to biblical studies. This may sound unusually strange to go at studying the Bible by not using it directly, but by using instead the encrustation of literature from the environment. But I'm convinced that not enough of this has been done in our church or in the Christian church in general, because we have a tremendously rich amount of material outside the Bible, which, as you know, relates directly inside it. I came across this quite by accident, I suppose. It was a professional accident. I should tell you where I'm coming from. I am not only professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University, but also campus chaplain to Lutheran students. Does this mean that I'm moonlighting? Two jobs? No, it's worse than that. It's out in the open. I'm sunlighting. A case of am I getting two salaries? Yes, but two substandard salaries equal one normal salary. Is this mixing church and state? Yes, I suppose it is. If Madeline Murray O'Hare heard about me, she'd probably have a stroke, which in itself wouldn't be too bad an idea. But actually, this has given me a unique opportunity to keep from doing the personal splits by anchoring one foot, in fact, in both disciplines. One squarely in the New Testament, and the other in the extra-biblical literature and archaeology, which, of course, addresses itself to this corner of the world. I think tremendously valuable lessons are lost because there aren't freaks like myself who try to bridge the two disciplines. And I think first of all, let's talk about sources. Where in the world do we get new light on the old story, that presumptuous title? You all know, I'm sure, about the extra-biblical materials that never got inside the Bible, but almost might have, had they been inspired, like Josephus' Wars and Antiquities, like the writings of Philo Judaeus, the Jewish philosopher of Alexandria, so directly in touch with the story that he could have rubbed elbows with Jesus at any one of the Passover festivals in Jerusalem. You know, I'm sure, about the rabbinical traditions that mention Jesus. And then, of course, the rich and detailed resources we have in Greco-Roman history and literature, all of which can be made, if you search hard enough, to impinge quite directly on some of the episodes, on some of the very personalities that you find inside the Bible. Beyond that, of course, is archaeology, which is, of course, unscheduled. You can't tell what the good earth is going to produce at a given dig. But since more archaeology is taking place over there, I think per acre than anywhere on earth, before you people pass on, there will be additional extremely valuable finds that will impinge on the Bible, Old and New Testament, or they may not. They may be perfectly oblique to it. But time and again where they do impinge, you know the affirmation ratio is extremely strong. So I congratulate you on choosing your generation and your parents to be born in this particular era. It's a tremendous time to be alive for Christians. The fact is that I'm sure all your professors would agree, we know far more about the New Testament world in which Jesus lived and died and rose again than our great father in the faith, Martin Luther, could possibly have known 500 years ago. More than St. Thomas Aquinas could have known, quite probably more even than St. Augustine could have known. That is how privileged we are today, I think, to use these resources. And my suggestion is simply, well, we ought then to go and use them. There are two reasons that I say we ought to. First of all, for the purpose of Christian apologetics. And secondly, because it's just fun and games to do it. It is just fun to get a new dimension on some of these biblical stories and episodes, to tell what Paul Harvey calls the rest of the story behind the story, to get a better dimensional view. Those are the two benefits, I think. Let me simply illustrate what I mean by those two benefits. When you go out in the world, you'll find that if you take on an atheist somewhere or a good, knowledgeable agnostic, one of the primary arguments he'll throw in your face is, quote, if Jesus is so all-fired important, how come his name is not mentioned in any first century sources outside the Bible? You would be shocked to find that 9 out of 10 Christians would respond to that by saying, well, the Bible's enough. That's all we need. Now, that's a fine theological answer. I'm not going to quarrel with it. But it's a terrible answer to that question because the question itself does not compute. If you misprogram a computer, you put garbage in and you get garbage out. And this question itself is garbage. Don't try to answer a question which is not phrased properly. Who says the name of Jesus doesn't show up in materials outside the New Testament? It does. Once when I made that point, an atheist from Florida wrote me after an article I had in Saturday Review. And he said, if you can name any of your famous sources, I'll give you or any charity you name $1,000. So I gave him 6. And I asked him to make the check, preferably for $6,000, payable to the Lutheran Student Center in Kalamazoo, which is my favorite charity. Needless to say, I never heard from him again. But let's just take one of those sources as a case in point. Rabbinical traditions in Sanhedrin 43a, where Yeshua HaNotzri is mentioned, Jesus the Nazarene. That's what they called him in those days. And it's the reason, by the way, that the Ozzie Hoffman special, which is finally going to come out next year, this documentary in the life of Christ, is going to be called Yeshua instead of the Israelite, which I think was a lousy name for it anyway. Yeshua is better. All right, the rabbinical tradition says, and this really is a rest notice, you know. It says, he shall be stoned because he has practiced sorcery and has led Israel to apostasy. And if you know of his whereabouts, tell the great Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. Now, this is a case of where we have definitely the same Jesus. There were a lot of Jesuses in those days, but we know this is the fellow for sure. And you may say, oh, well, wait a minute. That doesn't accord very well at all with the Bible, does it? Jesus was crucified and not stoned. Oh, yes, it does. Again, you got to get back to the Sitzim Leben. You got to see what's happening here. This is their viewpoint as to why they want Jesus hung up. And do you realize if you want to torpedo Jesus, the chances in any given year are 51 out of 52 that if you, as the priestly establishment over there, catch him, you will stone him to death, not crucify him. Why 51 out of 52 chances? Because Pontius Pilate is only in Jerusalem during the Passover week. Otherwise, he's at Caesarea, the Roman provincial capital. They didn't know when they were going to arrest Jesus. And so by the law of averages alone, they say he's going to be stoned. And then look at the riches of this one line in the rabbinical tradition. He has practiced sorcery. That's fabulous. Why? You know, sometimes I'm asked, is there any way to prove miracles outside the Bible? Well, you can't prove them, but boy, you get some fascinating straws in the wind. Here's one of them. Jesus evidently is really doing something there in these things called miracles that's visible, it's objective, that his enemies can see. They don't like it. But the way they try to tear it down is say Jesus is getting help from below, sorcery, not help from above, miracles. See? This is the kind of thing you would expect to see in the extra-biblical materials if something extraordinary is going on over there. So there's a one-liner. It just shows you the wealth of applicable data here as regards to the life of Christ. And then for other people, you have a whole congeries of episodes that are not recorded in the Bible. This is why I got hung up on Pontius Pilate. We know seven times as much about Pontius Pilate from materials outside the New Testament as the famous Good Friday event. Seven times as much. And in the big debate that currently is waged over, you know, responsibility for Good Friday and is the Sanhedrin involved or isn't it, you all know about the controversy that's raged for the last 10, 15 years on Jewish responsibility in Good Friday and how they're trying to rewrite the Passion story and how they accuse all the four Gospels of being hopelessly anti-Semitic and how there are cries to rewrite the New Testament on that basis and re-edit it. And how the story's getting skewed. How come nobody has bothered using what I like to call God's backup systems, these extra-biblical resources? If you're going to talk about Pilate, or if you want to change his role, how come nobody does his homework to look up this guy and see what else we know about the guy to help figure out why he's acting so strangely on Good Friday? He's acting strangely, I'll grant that. But there's a reason for it. Instead, our critics can come across with these marvelous reconstructions, like Menachem Begin in his last visit to Jimmy Carter in Washington. Remember Jimmy Carter? 700-page book called The Trial and Death of Jesus. 150 pages of footnotes, therefore very scholarly. The thesis in this book is that Annas and Caiaphas, far from being Jesus' opponents, were really his dear friends who were trying to keep him out of trouble with that dirty bird Pontius Pilate. And so the Gospels are hopeless, in other words. The real story, folks, if you want to know it in Holy Week, is the Romans are out to get Jesus, and the Sanhedrin may even be trying to defend him. Now, why do they try to rewrite the story this way? Oh, hey, the logic is really interesting. Let's say you're trying to launch the Christian church in Rome, okay? Here you are, you're in Vicarage, your first call, you're going down the Appian Way, knocking on doors, right? And I don't know what your opening line is, hi, we're taking a religious census, or, you know, and so forth. But you say, we'd like you to join this new Christian church in the catacombs at the edge of town. And they say, what's Christian, Gaius says, you know. And you say, well, Christian refers to a Jesus Christ who was crucified as a common criminal by one of your Roman governors. You know, slam. The equivalent would be a guy going from door to door in the dorms here saying that he wants to start a new cult in the SEM steam tunnels or something in honor of Charles Manson, the mass murderer in California. I mean, you wouldn't call a night watchman, you'd call the Clayton sheriff. So what you do is sweeten the message. Sweeten it a little bit by changing it. See, the Roman governor really wants to get Jesus, but now let's say he was pressured into it by the Jews, see? And so add this to the stupidity of the medieval church, which blamed the Jews collectively for Good Friday, see? And then the mea culpa today, the nostra culpa, we never should have done that, obviously. But that all is mixed up now into theological chic today, as your professors will tell you, is that you really got to take all the Gospels with a grain of salt when it comes to the Passion story. Pilate couldn't have done this. Couldn't have acted that way. I give you Rosemary Ruther. The picture of Pilate deigning to argue with the crowd is ludicrous, she writes. If Pilate were convinced of his innocence, as the Gospels say, he would have marched Jesus north up to Nazareth, and that would have been the end of it, under an honor guard. And that's when somebody like myself hits the ceiling, because they have not done their homework. They have not involved the episode of the golden Roman shields to account for Pilate's conduct on Good Friday. Now you may say, what's that? Never saw that in any CPH materials. Well, it's only an eyewitness account from Philo himself of Alexandria, contemporaneous with Pontius Pilate. He was there, and he writes about it in his famous embassy to Caligula. He tells about Pilate hanging up a couple of golden shields in his office in Jerusalem about a year before Good Friday, is the best chronology we can give to this. Now, these shields had no images on them. Pilate had his fingers burned on that one earlier, the episode of the Roman standards. These had no images. All it was were a couple of blank shields with an inscription at the edge, dedicated to Tiberius Caesar, given by Pontius Pilate, the equivalent of the governor of Missouri having not only a state flag in his office in Jefferson City, but an American flag as well. It's a token pledge of allegiance to the central regime. Philo tells us that Pilate next day got a visit from Herod Antipas, the one who killed John the Baptist, and his brothers. And Herod wants that shield, those shields taken down. Pilate stands his ground, doesn't take them down, because he knows what Herod is doing to him. Herod wants Pilate's job so bad he can taste it. He's in charge only of Galilee. He wants Judea and Samaria as well, so that he can be like dear old dad, you know, the Herod of the Christmas story, have all of Palestine under his control. So Josephus tells us that Herod is constantly, he's tattling on everybody over there. He talks about, he's trying to play leapkint, I guess we'd say brownie, as far as the emperor is concerned, constantly reporting on everything going on there. And in this case, he's trying to trap Pilate, put Pilate in a no-win situation. If Pilate takes the shields down, off goes a letter to Rome saying, "Dear Tiberius, your governor just took down his pledge of allegiance to you. I wonder what this means." If he left the shields hanging, "Dear Tiberius, your governor just doesn't have the right touch. He's managed to antagonize us in an area concerning our religion," or something nebulous like that. Pilate did the right thing, didn't take him down. 5 months before Good Friday, as best we can conclude on the basis of ancient mail service in winter or summer, Pilate gets this letter in nasty Latin from Tiberius, showing that Antipas had finked on him after all, behind his back, written to Rome, and Pilate is warned to take down those blankety-blank shields, and Pilate, from now on, you are on probation. Don't manage to antagonize those Jewish people in any manner affecting their religious sensitivities, because you will have outlived your usefulness in Judea if you do. You want to know what's hanging over Pilate's head on Good Friday? You want to know why he's acting strangely? You want to know why he feels pressured by the mob? You want to know why he can't simply release Jesus? Clear. The episode of the Golden Roman Shields. It comports perfectly with the New Testament account and explains his attitude. And as far as Annas and Caiaphas are concerned, the Jewish rabbinical traditions themselves mention them. And the Jews don't like them either. Woe to the house of Annas, woe to their serpent-like hisses. And in case you want to exonerate the Sanhedrin entirely, I give you the case of James, Bishop of Jerusalem, half-brother of Jesus of Nazareth, who, 32 years after Good Friday, was in a stunning parallel situation. In the absence of the Roman governor, the Pilate figure, the high priest and the Sanhedrin stoned this guy to death for Christianity. 62 AD. Now, it's a conclusive parallel. Later, when the Roman governor, the Pilate figure, in this case his name was Albinus, when he shows up, he's so ticked off at that arrogant, that lynching, see, on the Stephen model, that he canned the high priest. So the picture of a Roman governor being somewhat protective of an aberrant Jewish sect called the Christiani, see, to avoid violence like this, and the Sanhedrin as advocating violence, is perfectly endorsed one generation later. Now, does this mean I'm a great big anti-Semite because of what happened on Good Friday and blaming it all on the Jews? No, of course not. I'm going to have an article about 5 months from now in Christianity Today in which I look at it from a viewpoint that nobody seems to have thought of, and that's demographics. That's stratification of society. I can prove to you, I think, that if a plebiscite were held at Good Friday noon with one question on it, shall Jesus live or die, and every Jew in Jerusalem had a right to vote, Jesus would have won life by about 80% of the vote. You got all the Passover pilgrims there voting. You got Jesus' obvious popularity growing during Holy Week, not diminishing, people. And please, when you get out in the ministry, don't use this famous line, "Oh, the fickle crowd that could yell Hosanna to the Son of David on Palm Sunday and crucify him on Good Friday." I know, we've all used it. Different crowd, folks, different crowd. I'm not saying that, you know, nobody changed his mind on Jesus, but I'm saying that it is the temple establishment in Jerusalem which is primarily responsible. Annas, Caiaphas and the boys, the Levites, the sacrifice people, the priestly establishment, the temple guards. You add them all together, Josephus tells us there were 10,000 running the temple. You want a lynch mob? You want somebody to come along that can be perfectly orchestrated to ask for Barabbas or Jesus? You got it. There it is. But it's patently stupid ever to have collectively blamed the Jews. Now that's the way out of anti-Semitism, not trying to rewrite the New Testament Gospels. You know, Josephus, you can prove to your parishioners, by the way, how they've all used a little bit of Josephus without them knowing it. I've proved to you, too. If I would ask you to tell me the story of how John the Baptist was executed, you would tell me about Herod Antipas' birthday party and Herodias coming along with that floor show, right? Her daughter doing the dance of traditionally the seven veils and all that. Okay, what's the gal's name? Salome, right. But I challenge you to find her name in the Gospels. You won't. You'll find Salome as one of the gals who came out to the Easter tomb. Different Salome, I tend to think, or... We really have an example of personality transformation. Nope, Josephus tells us the same account, pinpoints it to Machaerus, the fortress of Herod the Great at the northeastern end of the Dead Sea, just opposite from Masada, which is also Josephus' work, as you know, and names the girl. So it shows you this valuable interplay between these sources in the New Testament. Hey, this thing I just told you about, the episode of the Golden Shields, explains that verse in Luke, which has no commentary otherwise in the New Testament. The verse I'm referring to is when Jesus is sent over to the tribunal of Herod Antipas during the Good Friday process, remember? And Pilate is clever. He's killing two birds with one stone. He's getting rid of this religious case that he doesn't want to handle. And he's mending diplomatic fences with this fellow who's constantly tattling on him. Wave an olive branch. Maybe he'll shut up. So that's the reason Jesus goes over there. Herod, of course, wants a magic show and sends Jesus back. But then there's that one verse in Luke. And Herod and Pilate were made friends that same day because before this they had been hostile with one another. I submit the New Testament does not tell us why they were hostile, but the episode of the Golden Roman Shields does tell us why they were hostile and why they were now friends. And so there once again is a perfect example of the extra-biblical material meshing perfectly with the New Testament and really explaining it. Even the way Jesus was crucified has come under critical attack. You may remember the late, not-so-great Bishop Pike, that postgraduate Christian who was off in Palestine doing research on another put down in the life of Christ, and he was going, his big climax was to disprove that they ever nailed Jesus to the cross. He says they tied him to the cross because human flesh is too fragile, wouldn't tolerate a nail. A nail would wiggle out in the webbing between the fingers. And supposedly they even proved it once. I don't know who lent himself to the experiment of... Christians used to be sensitive on that. They used to say, well, it's true if you take even a 60-penny spike, human flesh is pretty fragile here, and they put it in the wrist instead of the palms. See, that was the standard way out. Well, rejoice, Christians, you don't have to use any way out anymore because the archaeology is in, about a dozen years ago. A bulldozer was working its way through northeastern Jerusalem. I should point out that a bulldozer is not your average archaeological tool. This one was doing a housing development and scraped open the side of a hill, and there they found a collection of ossuaries, stone bone chests, kind of a space-saving way to bury people in those days, one-by-one-by-three-foot chests that have some dead people in their bones. And one of these victims was named Yochanan ben Hagalgol, John the son of Galgal. There's no reference to him in Josephus or Philo or anybody else, so we don't know who he was. But the archaeology shows that he was between 28 and 34, that he had a triangular face, had good teeth, had a cleft palate, and he was crucified by nailing because there's a hole in the distal end of his right radius bone. Both of his legs broken below the kneecap. I mean, that's just perfect confirmation on what they did to the malefactors on each side of Jesus on Good Friday to induce death. It's standard operating procedure for crucifixion, evidently. And then 7 inches worth of spike still lodged in his heel bones. Now, this was widely publicized a dozen years ago or so. You probably all know about it. But what most of the reports failed to mention was the physics of it all. How do you hold fragile flesh on the cross with a spike? Well, right beneath the head of the nail, they found the rotting remains of acacia wood, the wood they used for building the tabernacle. And obviously this was the secret. It was a washer, a plaque, a wedge that they used. So the procedure is first the spike goes into this washer to increase the area that the head can hold. Then that whole affair, thumbtack-like, went on the victims. I don't care. Wrist, palm, makes no difference. This fellow happened to get it in the wrist. A perfect confirmation on what they did to Jesus. And so it's there's no longer any debate anywhere with any scholar who's up in the literature. Yes, Virginia, they nailed people to the cross. It's quite clear. There it is. So I had a lot of fun with this Christmas and Easter and Christians book project. These are not novels. These are only the facts and the documentation. I put photographs of that victim's bones in my Easter book so that Spike and all the critics could get the point. Then I went out on a limb. As far as Easter's concerned. I really tried to use this method to see if we could go shed new light on the Easter phenomenon. Most Christians assume, again, that every last detail about what happened on the third day is locked in at the tail end of the four Gospels, and that's all. You believe them or you don't, and that's it. And there's no way for something as extraordinarily supernatural as this to ever be attested to by anything on the outside. Wrong. Now, to be sure, I cannot use this method to prove, quote-unquote, the resurrection. If I could, it would be simple. I'd have a bestseller for the next 10,000 years. The whole world would have to go Christian if it could read. It'd be very simple. God doesn't want it that way. It eliminates this item called faith. But hold it, people. There are two discrete phenomena that took place on Easter Sunday morning. One, Jesus rose from the dead. Two, as a result of that resurrection, the tomb must have been empty, right? Yeah, okay. Empty tomb. That we can prove. Now you're going to say, come on, how can you prove an empty tomb? I can prove it on the basis of non-biblical materials alone. Now, of course, the critics used to say, oh, come on, the early church doesn't talk much about the empty tomb and so forth. They're not interested in it. Of course they're not. Who cares about the empty tomb? In the sense of, you get a letter from your sweetheart or so, what counts, the letter or the envelope? The empty tomb is the envelope of the resurrection. The empty tomb is the husk, the shell of the resurrection, not the meat, the kernel, the core. So the early church is thrilled to have a risen Christ, doesn't care about the empty tomb. Nevertheless, from the point of view of secular history, we have some fascinating material on the empty tomb. Now, I don't know why we didn't learn about that here at 801 Diman, but I came across it in the Jewish rabbinical traditions, and I just about shot off another skyrocket. I couldn't believe this, that in the Jewish traditions themselves, in whose interest it would be to shut up about anything connected with Easter, or even to fib about it, they admit an empty tomb. Now, you're all familiar with the one standard demonstration of the empty tomb, which is terrific, which has never, ever been contradicted in 1900 years, and you should continue to use it. It's the one argument that even the German higher critics have a lot of trouble with. And Pannenberg and others will use it positively. And that is the argument of the origin of Christianity, that Christianity developed only one place in this globe, you know, not even regionally. There's one city alone where it first started as the kerygma of the resurrection, and that's the city of Jerusalem. And of course, the argument is from circumstantial evidence. There, least of all, could the faith have ever begun if the moldering body of Jesus of Nazareth were available in the disputes that followed the apostolic preachment after Easter. You know, the first chapters in Acts are full of this stuff about how Caiaphas trying to keep him shut up, put him in prison, in and out. He wouldn't have done any of this if Jesus' body were available. He'd have conducted a little stroll over to Joseph's tomb, kicked the stone aside. There it is. Behold, it's the end of Christianity. We wouldn't be here today under these circumstances. Period. And it's true. There simply is no way of opposing that argument, and it still is a very tremendously strong argument for the empty tomb. But I add to that now what I call positive testimony and a hostile source. This is what you call self-authenticating testimony. It's something rare for an ancient historian to find this kind of thing, because in so many historical statements, especially from 2,000-3,000 years ago, we have to, you know, adjust for the bias of the source. We have to see what else is going on. We have to see, you know, is Josephus primping up the Jews too much? Yes, at many places he is, and so forth. And so it's very difficult to find a statement that proves itself. But when you find a datum, which is what in court is called an admission against interest, in the legal profession, you know, where you bring something out in court and both sides have to agree to it because it's patent, it's obvious. If you lie about that, even if it hurts your case, everybody know you're lying about something else too, maybe, so you have to admit it. That's what positive testimony in a hostile source is. And so when in the rabbinical traditions themselves, you have various versions of Easter trickling down, even to a version of Judah, the gardener, who had snuck the body out of his tomb and buried it elsewhere and wants 30 pieces of silver from the high priest and he'll tell him where the body is, you know, garbled versions. This, I find, is a fascinating, interesting, and almost direct confirmation of the empty tomb phenomenon. There's even some archaeology to bear. It doesn't prove anything, but boy, when you add up all these straws in the wind, it's really wild. You have the Nazareth inscription of Claudius, warning against grave robbery or breaking seals. You got to remember, all these rabbinical traditions don't say Jesus rose from the dead. They all say the body was stolen, which is great. All we're trying to prove is an empty tomb, folks. they may not even say the tomb was empty, but they said the body was stolen. So what is that, folks, but an empty tomb? QED. Now, I went out on a professional limb when the Easter book was published, arguing purely from the point of view of ancient history that the tomb was empty. I expected to get clobbered across the world. I did not. It's not that it didn't go public. The argument was bald and patent and public because Lou Cassells, the United Press International Religion writer, took my empty tomb argument and used that for his Easter column across the states and across the world for the newspapers. And the book itself was syndicated in about 200 daily newspapers. So the argument is out, and I've challenged, other scholars that if they can find in the first 4 centuries A.D. any reference from any source that the tomb was still occupied on Sunday morning, I want to know about it because then I'll gladly eat crow. But I have not found it. The latest book in the life of Jesus by a Jew from Tel Aviv, Galia Kornfeld, just published by Macmillan. The Historian's View of Jesus, it's called, not only admits my argument for the empty tomb, but incorporates my chapter 11 in the Easter book because he's absolutely convinced. He says, the debate and the dialogue between Jews and Christians must begin now from the fact of the empty tomb. He admits it, to me, it's a new high in Jewish-Christian relations. They even allowed me about 5 pages of critique at the end of the book for his own book. Which is marvelous. I was just thrilled at that. But there's a respected scholar, a close friend of Benjamin Mazar, who admits that the tomb was empty. Simply has to. Well, all I'm saying is, through the use of extra-biblical materials, we can make an unusually strong case for the credibility of the faith. Something which none of the other religions in this world can do, by the way. This is the thing that sets Christianity apart. Take Confucianism, great Confucius. It's a debate yet as to whether it's an ethical system or religion or Lao Tzu or Buddha sitting under the bow tree. When? The Indians dating him 900, 800 B.C., the Chinese 500 B.C. How's that for precision, folks? 300 years difference. Or Zoroaster, the founder of Zoroastrianism. Scholars usually date him either 3,000 B.C. or 500 B.C. Isn't that nice? Real precision, folks. To the nearest 2,500 years, he lived sometimes. Compare that with Luke chapter 3, verse 1, the beginning of John's ministry and therefore Jesus's. Luke pinpointing it in the 15th year of the Emperor Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, footnote 2. When Annas and Caiaphas were high priests, footnote 3. When Herod Antipas was tetrarch of Galilee, footnote 4. When Philip, his brother, was tetrarch of Trachonitis, which is presumably not a disease. And when Lysanias was tetrarch of Abilene, presumably not Kansas, and so on, down the list. There you have, one after the other, these footnotes for precision purposes. What a difference. What a difference. Now, when it comes to the great explosion of Christianity across the Mediterranean world, there the needle goes off the scale. And I mean, I could give a week's worth of lectures alone on what I was supposed to talk about, the Greco-Roman perspective in biblical studies, because this is the mainstream now, people, of classical history. It's not the boondocks. Remember, Palestine is the boondocks of the ancient world. Asia Minor and Greece and Rome, that's the mainstream. And here we have many more literary references, a whole lot of archaeology. We can almost check out St. Paul's missionary journeys, chapter and verse at places, backing it up with all sorts of tangencies. My favorite guidebook in the ruins at Corinth today is Acts 18, or 1st and 2nd Corinthians, because you can follow there alone. You have 6 points of tangency between the non-biblical materials and the biblical materials. I'll just rattle them off real quick. Where did Paul begin preaching? In the synagogue, naturally. Well, we'll show you where that was, because there's a white marble block discovered, Ho Synagoge Tes Hebraeis, the synagogue of the Hebrews, on the main north-south highway in Corinth leading to the Lycaon sector or port. We can tell you where Paul continued preaching after he got kicked out of the synagogue, right next door. Remember, with Paul's beautiful subtlety, when he converted Crispus, the president of the synagogue. They asked him to preach elsewhere. So, you know, with the subtlety of a crashing jet plane, he chooses right next door to the synagogue, the house of Titius Justus, to continue preaching, probably through the open windows, trying to get his message to the synagogue. Meat sacrifice to idols, that big controversy. He says, when you go into the meat market, the macellum, there's a Latinism which he uses, we can show you where the macellum was. That was across the street and down a ways. Sort of the Krogers of ancient Corinth there. Then, as you know, he was brought before Gallio, the proconsul of Achaia, that means governor of Greece. The Romans had shifted the capital from Athens to Corinth now. And that's where the governor hung his hat. And you know, this the first test case for Christianity in the Mediterranean world is tremendously important. And you know, Gallio threw the case out of court. Thank God Paul could continue his missionary journeys. And we show you where the bema, the tribunal was, where Gallio sat, where Paul stood before him and so. And I guess what I weep about is that Gallio, you know, shows up in the book of Acts, and that's all we know about him. We'll even misuse him like Billy Graham did once. He was preaching a sermon on indifference, and the text was, but Gallio cared for none of these things. Indifference indeed. Thank goodness he didn't care for the case of St. Paul and threw it out. But this guy is more than a cardboard figure. This guy is famous in Roman history. How come we don't know more about him? How come we don't relate into this fellow? His brother was the most famous Stoic philosopher of the first century, Aeneas Seneca, his full-blooded brother. It's an absolute anchor in Pauline chronology because Claudius writes a letter to Gallio dating to the year 52 AD, and Gallio's only as governor there for a year. Caught malaria, went back home. His brother Seneca says, go back via Egypt. You'll enjoy the pyramids. These guys come to life if you bring these other sources. And he does. He does go back home. He's quite a wit, Gallio was. He said, if Claudius died, he must have been hooked up to heaven. Now, this just, you know, drove the Roman to paroxysms of laughter. I see it didn't do much for you. The way they used to take care of criminals was to drag their bodies down to the Tiber, see? So if this guy was deified, he must have been hooked up to heaven, is the way he put it. Well, anyway, later, Gallio served as master of ceremonies in Nero's recitals, which was really a difficult thing to do because Nero was a very poor artist. And I don't think that St. Paul might not have availed himself of Gallio's deposition when he stood before Nero later on, because Gallio is still very much alive and available in Rome. Paul should have done that in his trial before Nero. Sometimes it's only a name. I give you Romans 16, end of Romans. Paul sending greetings from everybody to everybody. Phoebe says hello, you know, these wonderful names. Toward the end of it, he says, Erastus. Erastus, Erastus, the city manager of Corinth, sends you his greetings. The implication is Erastus is a Christian. And, of course, the critics used to hoot and holler at that one, claiming there never was an Erastus. If there was an Erastus, he wasn't city manager. If he was a city manager, he wasn't a Christian. Well, we get nothing else in the New Testament, really. I think there's one other place at the end of an epistle that Erastus does show up, but that's all. He's just a name. Well, good old archaeology comes through. At the ruins of Corinth today, by the way, nobody knows about this, unless you're lucky to talk to the museum curator at Corinth. None of the tourist guides know about this. You've got to cross the street, past the souvenir stands, and on the other side from the Temple of Apollo, in the weeds, you'll see the ruins of a Greco-Roman theater in need of cleaning out. And at the top, there is a white marble pavement. And there it is in 3-inch bronze inlay lettering from the time of Claudius, the following inscription. Erastus, the city manager of Corinth, has presented this plaza to the people of Corinth during his administration. So, folks, There it is. Just a one-liner in the New Testament, perfectly borne out by archaeology. And so it goes. It's possible using this approach, finally, and then we're going to throw it open for questions. It's possible using this approach even to try to fill in some of the holes in the New Testament. Now, I know this sounds presumptuous, and I know you may say, well, wait a minute, what holes? Oh, there are, of course, lacunae. There are hiatuses in the life story of Jesus. Tell me about his teenage years, huh? All you have is the 12-year-old Jesus in the temple. We can't do a whole lot more with his youth, unfortunately. I tried to in chapter 12 of the Christmas book, but we have many novels about Jesus' youth. I'm telling you, there were Taylor Caldwell's back 1,900 years ago. They tell these wonderful stories about Jesus in the carpenter shop, you know, when Joseph, the old duffer carpenter, would saw a beam too short. All he'd do is call Jesus over. Jesus goes zap, and the beam would be the right size. Wonderful stories. But we do get some authentic data from patristics. Now, I don't usually use patristics. They're too late for me, believe it or not. But I make an exception with good old Justin Martyr, because he is early, and he is a neighbor of Jesus, next door up in Samaria. He tells us, for example, about the cavern, the cave where Jesus was born, not the stable per se. And he tells us that Joseph and Jesus and the carpenter shop up in Nazareth were specialists in agricultural implements. They made yokes for oxen and made plowshares. And he says they were extremely well made and were serviceable into the 2nd century A.D., his own day, middle of the 2nd century. Now, of course, we knew our Lord would do good work, but what you may not have known is that he was the John Deere dealer up in Nazareth, you see. So there are some of these hiatuses that can be filled in, and I think ought to be filled in. Same also for the way the book of Acts ends. Now, I love the life of St. Paul, always fascinated by it, especially as he plunges into the Greco-Roman world and so on, and I've always been frustrated by the ending of the book of Acts. And I think any serious student should be. You have an unresolved fate out here. You have Paul coming into Puteoli, the Bay of Naples. They head up the Appian Way. They're met by this delegation of Roman Christians at a place called the Three Taverns, which proves it was a Lutheran delegation, not a Methodist. And then they go on into the city of Rome itself. And he's there for 2 years, preaching the gospel quite openly, and then what? We don't know. Luke does his famous fade-out, his unresolved fade-out, which is a very contemporary device. It's used all the time by our novelists who don't know how to end their novels, by our TV films, you know, just when you're really ripening up to the plot. If any of you saw V a while ago, you may recall one of the worst endings in all of history. Just totally leaves you hanging. But it's a little unbiblical. And then imagine my joy and chagrin to find out that if we only beat the bushes of the ancient world, if we only check into, I like to call them God's backup systems, history and archaeology, that we find somebody picking up the account only 2 years later, if this is about 62 A.D. when Paul has been in prison for 2 years. We have specific hard data for 64 A.D. I refer, of course, to Tacitus and the Great Fire of Rome, Nero getting blamed for it, Nero transferring the blame to the Christians. Their first mention in secular history chronologically. Isn't that terrific, where Luke really leaves off just 2 year interim there? We have a pagan historian picking up the story on the Christians. Almost an overlap. So So I was convinced that it was high time that somebody undertake here a reconstruction of St. Paul's subsequent fate. Pontius Pilate and The Flames of Rome are both called novels. They shouldn't be really. We have to do that for the popular market. What they are is reconstructions in which we incorporate only real historical personalities. We don't invent anybody. We never contradict known historical fact, and we try to reconstruct by every device possible what happened. And in this case, I was convinced that finally we have enough hard and soft data to attempt a reconstruction of Paul's trial before Nero, something that, to my knowledge, has simply never been done before. Through new evidence from the catacombs, from patristics, from our knowledge today of Greco-Roman law, and I did a special study on the way Nero acted and what his schedule was year by year in Rome and what kind of cases he heard on appeal and what kind of cases he didn't hear. And I think there are 7 out of 10 chances that my reconstruction of the trial before Nero, it's the middle, the centerpiece of The Flames of Rome, is accurate. A normal novel, you wouldn't find 37 pages of notes in the back. More like Schwiebert's Life of Luther. anyway, the hints we get from the Epistle to the Romans and from the prison epistles can all be worked up into what I think is a doable reconstruction of what happened after Acts 28 breaks off. At first, the going title for The Flames of Rome was Acts 29 Following, but I decided, no, we couldn't really do that. But everything you find from all the hints that Paul drops also in the Epistle to the Romans really works out admirably from what we know from history and archaeology as far as the Roman Church is concerned. It is a marvelous example of a lay movement, people. You know the church in Rome was not founded by Paul or by Peter. It was founded evidently by those first proselytes and Jews at the Pentecost episode in Acts 2. You know where Luke gives us this geography job, all these places all over, because Paul hadn't even set foot in Rome yet. And how does he begin Romans chapter 1? I thank my God your faith is spoken of throughout the world. My goodness, this thing is there in force. So much so that they spend a week down in the Bay of Naples before they even go up to Rome in the Appian Way. That's how strongly entrenched it is already in Puteoli and Herculaneum and probably Pompeii. This is only 30 years after Good Friday, people. When Nero persecutes the Christians, Tacitus says, a vast multitude of Christians were available for persecution. That is only 31 years after Good Friday. That suddenly rang a bell with me, and I did a comparative study on how fast Epicureanism and Stoicism and all these other religions got to Rome. It took them a century or more. And here we have 1,500 miles away. It takes, you know, these Greek religions a century to cross the Adriatic Sea, 50 miles wide. This one leapfrogs to Rome in one lousy generation 1,500 miles away. So who's right, Luke on Pentecost or the critics who say this was a very quiet each one reach one campaign? This is endorsed by Paul's claims in Philippians where he says, I want you to know the whole Praetorian Guard knows my imprisonments for Christ. At Philippians 4 he says, the saints in Caesar's household pray for you. There's even a subterranean church up there in the palace. This thing is growing. And it really is an eloquent testimony to what the Holy Spirit can do through the laity. But when Paul writes in Romans, right on, you know, it's his X-rated verses, where he frankly talks about homosexuality. He begins with lesbianism, and he moves on to homosexuality and so forth. Paul knew what he was talking about because, let me tell you, this is the stinkiest seedbed that Christianity could ever have been seeded in the entire Mediterranean basin, because the years in which the faith took root there are unparalleled in terms of sensuality and everything else that was going wrong. Just a brief brief overview. Claudius is in charge. His third wife is named Messalina. Perfect name for her because she was messing around all the time. We know 16 famous Romans with whom she slept when her husband wasn't looking. Now, adultery at the summit has been known before, but have you ever heard of this one? One day while Claudius was at the beach, and without bothering to tell him or divorce him, she publicly married somebody else in Rome? Quaint, isn't it? The fellow she married is appropriately named Gaius Silius. You think Ian Fleming, you know, we're writing Roman history here with, you know, Miss Galore and all these famous characters. The witch in Rome who was poisoning everybody was named Locusta, female locust, you know. Unbelievable, these names. Anyway, well, Claudius comes back, discovers the plot, rolls some heads, and then promises celibacy from now on. Well, he's faithful to that promise for at least the next 10 months. And then his dear niece comes along. Agrippina was her name. And she, well, of course, she had the right to kiss Uncle Claudius anytime she felt like it, but she kind of overdid it. And, seduced him, and they got married. Now, don't try to do this to your niece, folks. It's called incest. The Romans were civilized enough to call it incest also. But the Senate passed a special law allowing uncles to marry nieces, and so now it was all very legal. Agrippina comes to this marriage with a little son by a previous marriage in hand. His name's Nero. And now she schemes so that he will succeed instead of Claudius's own son, Britannicus, who was 3 years younger at a very critical early teenage time. Claudius gets wise, is ready to take care of his wife, only she takes care of him first with her famous dish of poisoned mushrooms. It was in October of 54 that poor Claudius' head slumped over in the platter. By the way, didn't quite do the job. They had to take care of him the next morning through a poison enema. Poor Claudius, they got him at both ends. Also that little Nero could succeed. And then, of course, the first 5 years of his administration, it's his tutor, Gallio's brother Seneca, who is running the show in Rome. Best 5 years of government Rome ever had, because Nero's growing up and Seneca is ruling the empire wisely. Until in the year 59, Nero and his mother, Nero takes over, and now he's going to cut the apron strings. Mama is angry at that. So Nero ponders the ultimate solution to the problem of his mother. This all has implications to the book of Acts. I'll tell you in a second. He has to make it an accidental death for dear old mom, right? So he first tries the collapsible bedroom ceiling ploy. Romans loved their gadgets, you know. This didn't work. So then he invites her down to the Bay of Naples for a feast of reconciliation. And at midnight when they bid each other goodbye, he then puts her on a cabin cruiser, which can, well, Tacitus describes it, frankly, as a collapsible cabin cruiser. This one is a trapdoor in the hold, which would scuttle a ship, crew would swim away, and then Mama would drown by an accident. See? Only the idiots built the trapdoor so it opened out instead of in. So this thing works fine in dry dock, see, but when they're out in the Bay of Naples, they can't budge it. So then they try to sink the ship by going to the starboard rail, port rail, starboard rail, port rail, you know, get her rocking. And just as they're ready to scuttle it, the crew comes pouring up on the deck. They thought their officers had gone stark raving mad. They weren't in on the plot, so they stabilized the roll by rushing to the opposite rail each side. Meanwhile, Mama, who's a good swimmer, surprise, surprise, jumps over the rail and swims away. At 1 a.m., she is picked up in the water by a flotilla of oyster fishermen who bring her on shore. Now, I ask you folks, could you get away with this if it were a novel? It'd be blue-penciled. But someone once said, truth is stranger than fiction. It really happened. It really happened. So Nero then sends the Marines, and they club her to death the next morning. Nero has committed, by the way, it was on Mama's bed that they clubbed her to death, which is therefore called matricide. Sorry about that. Pretty bad. Pretty bad. But this is the reason why Paul is waiting 2 years in Rome for his trial. Nero is so afraid at being accused of matricide and therefore paying the horrible Roman penalty for matricide that he doesn't show his face in Rome for about the next year. He batted about southern Italy. He wasn't even available for trial, you see. And so that's one of the reasons for the delay. Anyway, this is the way, if we check the extra-biblical materials, how we can really fill the story in, I think, pretty adequately. Yes, after Paul's trial before Nero, I do think he beat the rap the first time. There's too much evidence now, too much evidence that he had a briefly extended ministry. The Muratorian fragment of the canon tells about his trip to Spain, how Paul went to the eastern end of the Mediterranean very briefly. Hey, if you believe in the Pauline authorship of the pastoral epistles, I think you better agree with me that he beat the rap, because there's just no way to fit the pastorals in earlier into Paul's standard ministry if it ends with death in Rome before Nero. There's no reason to kill this guy yet. The Christians are not illegal. They are perfectly legal yet. There has not really been a test case to speak of, but they're still legal. They get illegalized because of that fluke called the Fire of Rome. I say fluke because the Romans were syncretistic. The more the merrier, they didn't care. Jews were welcome in Rome, occasionally kicked out, but welcome back. Isis and Osiris, Mithraism, all these other religious beliefs were welcome. Why not the Christians too? The Jews looked like a special Jewish cult or sect anyway. What happened was the Fire of Rome. If we ask you, you know, what caused it, you'll give me this one-liner about Nero fiddling while Rome burned. That's another one to drop out of your stable of phrases, because the fiddle itself will not be invented for 14 centuries yet. And the fire was accidental. Nero himself was 35 miles away at the time. And it was an accidental fire that got out of hand. And in those days, you know, before Dan Rather shows up in CBS Evening News to tell you what caused the fire, the rumor mills would build. You blame the top man in charge. You always do. So Nero got blamed for it. His government is at stake. And to save himself, then, they probably went through the list. Shall we try the criminals of Rome? No, they'll turn and say they've been put up to it. Let's try the Jews of Rome, you know. No. Poppaea, his empress, would have vetoed that because she was almost a proselyte. So while you're on the subject, though, how about that special brand of Jews that have just come along? These Christers, these Christiani. Yeah, perfect. So they're the scapegoats. So then the horror of the first persecution began in response to that fluke. And the horrendous torments you're all familiar with, sewn inside of animal skins, the Christians were made to fight with animals, crucified, beheaded, and the worst of all is when daylight failed, they were impaled on posts daubed with pitch and set on fire to illuminate Nero's spectacles. But as you know, the blood of the martyrs, the seed of the church, as Tertullian said, and so it was. So quite a story followed Acts 28. And I think I've jabbered long enough. Maybe at this point, Mr. Chairman, may we throw this open to questions?
Certainly.
Great.
Would you like me to moderate?
No, that's all right. I can field them. Any questions you have about anything at all you'd like to ask about this particular approach? Yes. Yes.
You have any comments about the theory of the Jehovah's Witnesses that the Stoura that our Lord was crucified on was not a cross, but crossfire of sin? That must be translated.
Okay, you're right. The JWs make a big fuss about the hung on a tree or a stick or a stake and not the cross per se. I don't know. This is a case of much ado about nothing. You find these cults come along, and they specialize in one particular direction to try to unhinge your implicit belief in the Bible or whatever else, or the way you've been taught. Garner Ted Armstrong and the Universal Worldwide Church of God, whatever he calls his outfit, do the same thing with trying to convert Good Friday into Good Wednesday and Maundy Tuesday so that you can have the 3 days and all this kind of thing. The general method there was the vertical post stays in place, and you take this patibulum or cross beam. The very fact that the Romans have different names for the devices in the cross, I think, disproves it. The patibulum as the cross beam is what Jesus himself carried out to Calvary, and this had a hole in it and usually dropped over the vertical beam that remained there. It is the normal way of hanging somebody up, and it would be a flashier way, really, of crucifying somebody than simply being up over like this, which the JWs claim. And don't forget, the crucifixion is eminently an advertisement as a deterrent to imply that you should not do what this guy did so that you don't get hung up like he is. And so, again, I wouldn't give it the time of day. Any other questions? Yes, George.
You mentioned the catacombs a couple of times, and I've heard some statements that the catacombs really weren't being used by the Christian church until about the second century. Did you comment on that?
That's true, Professor Roberts. Professor Roberts, singular. He is a singular person anyway. I have a friend named Roberts, hence the slip. I will admit, George, that what I did there was to try, because the catacombs are anchored in Roman archaeology per se so much, that I do use for my first century references much less from the catacombs than might otherwise thought to be the case. The central figure in Flames of Rome is the brother of Vespasian named Flavius Sabinus, and the archaeology I used for him is from the Roman Forum itself. Now, we do have, of course, the catacombs evidence coming in when we're trying to tease out the case of Pomponia Graecina. Now, Tacitus tells us about this gal who is the wife of the Roman conqueror of Britain, who seems to be the first Roman of nobility to convert to Christianity in the year 57 AD, 7 years before the Great Fire of Rome. Now, Pomponia herself later willed her property to somebody who willed it on in the catacombs of Domitilla, so that there is a section there of other Pomponia Graecini. And in the second century, it seems that her family or heirs converted. So that's the evidence that I use from the second century to work back into the first century. But I'll admit, there's not a whole lot. That's a correct point. Yes?
I hate to bring this up, to go on for a while, but what's your opinion of the shroud?
Shroud, I tell you, I have a handy-dandy method for authenticity that I use when people really want to know, is this, when I take a tour to the Holy Land, I take a group and they want to know, did it really happen here and so forth. Everybody wants to know that. So I have a 1 to 10 scale. 10 is absolutely authentic. Yes, it happened here. 1 is zip. This is a device that I invented long before Bo Derek came along, I want you to know. And I'm usually very picky about my 10s. I'll use 10 only for the Sea of Galilee over there in the Jordan River, you know. Anyway, on this scale, I used to give the shroud about a -5. I just wasn't interested at all. Reminded me of the first scenes in the Luther film, you know, where they're bringing wood from the true cross and so forth, all this wonderful stuff, which if you gathered together would fill 10 lumber yards. I'm up to a +3, only because the scientists are so all-fired interested in it. And they, you know, they have done some interesting tests. Can linen survive this long? Yeah, it can. I can take you to the Egyptian Museum in Cairo and show you a shroud from the tomb of King Tutankhamun that's 1,400 years older than the Shroud of Turin, even if it's authentic, see. So it could be. However, they have not done the proper test in the Shroud. And I'm so angry that they haven't that I will not give it more than a +3 until they do carbon-14. If they do a carbon-14 test on it, and it shows a vastly old garment, plus or minus 50 years, 1900, 2100 years old, yes, then I will be very, very much impressed. Why haven't they done a carbon-14? Because they were afraid they'd have to destroy too much of the Shroud. This is no longer true. They have a better method of carbon-14 dating. It was unveiled about a year and a half ago. We just had a conference at Western. It went on the same time George's medieval conference. And that is a direct ratio of carbon-14 to carbon-12 through Van de Graaff tandem acceleration. And they could now take 1 square centimeter of the Shroud and authenticate it on that basis. So unless and until they do a carbon-14 dating, I'm not interested in going beyond 3. Yes?
I'm just wondering about what kind of, or what specific extra biblical material you would recommend for people of limited resources and time.
Well, thank you for mentioning that, nephew. No. He's unrelated to me, as God is my witness. I don't know him. I appreciate the question, though. Because the response may sound like a commercial, but it isn't. People, I was there in those seats, I like to think, a very short time ago, but now instead of saying I'm a professor of ancient history, they're starting to call me an ancient professor of history. But I can remember my student days, too, and how expensive books were. So what I worked out was a handy-dandy scheme whereby, and I please hope that the manager of the bookstore won't hate me for this, but without even bothering him, I want to make these books available at a cost basis to you guys, which is 40% discount, which is what they cost me. Then nobody's making a profit, and then this won't sound like a commercial, okay? If you're interested, we have samples of the books on the table at the end of the table, at the end of the room. And what you do is take these little blue slips, put your name down, and check off whichever titles you want. Yes, I'll happily autograph them. You know, your wife may appreciate it. Who knows? Or husband, as the case may be. Don't let that be construed as a sexist remark. And what you do is then leave the blue slips here and then call for the books about 10 days from now in Gladys Sulflew's office, first floor of E Dormitory Steckhardt, okay? This way, it's we can know exactly how many books to send down. And I'll actually be losing a little bit on the postage, but I'm happy to do it. So this way, it's not commercial and nobody's making any money. In response to your question, the answer is, yes, we have everything neatly worked out in all of the footnotes to all those books as to where you can find this stuff. Yes?
If there was so much crime and corruption at the top of the Roman government during the first century, how in the world did the Roman government survive and even expand during that period?
Good question. Did you hear it all? Do I have to repeat it? Fortunately, this is mainly only at the summit. It did not permeate all of society this way. Anybody who knows classical history, I think, will be amazed at how moral and ethical the people basically were apart from the ethics of Judaism and Christianity. How ethical pagans could be. And boy, it's kind of a natural law, you know, of God written in their heart or something. So really, you find that generally, not everybody, you know, the Romans did not conclude each day with an orgy and that kind of stuff, no. And banquets that lasted until midnight. No, the people were more moral than their leaders in many ways. Yes?
How accurate is the TV episode of I, Claudius?
I, Claudius wasn't really too bad in the sense of Roman society being, you know, pretty sodden here at the summit. Except that Graves, who doesn't use my three rules for accuracy, had too many poisonings. I mean, everybody is poisoning everybody else in that picture. And he miscasts Mrs. Caesar Augustus. Terribly, terribly wronged in that series. He needed a female heavy, and so Graves zeroed in on her. And actually, Octavia Olivia, I should say, the wife of Augustus, was a lot better a woman than comes out in those pages. No, none at all. None at all. What would she have to gain? Supposedly the story is that Augustus took only fresh fruit from now on because he suspected his wife, and so he went out to pick it off the tree, but Livia had been there first and had coated the figs and so on. No truth to that at all. Yes? No, not at all. This is one of the cases where I never cease to be amazed at how beautifully condoning the state can be. Now, I know if I were in California, maybe, or places like this that are quite secularist, I'd have a good deal more difficulty straddling this particular situation as I have it. But certainly not in the Midwest, and the university administration, quite on the contrary, is pleased with my publications. They know they're Christian in intent. They know that I'm honest with the use of the materials, though, and they've not failed to promote me all the way to full professor and give me various awards for teaching and scholarship and that kind of thing. So they're really very, very open about it. It's very pleasant. Yes?
I seem to recall something I read in your first Easter book about the accusation that Pontius Pilate was no friend of Caesar, and there was some significance to that. Could you comment on that phrase?
Oh, yeah. Here's a case where, you know, you could take a biblical phrase, and if you use these extra-biblical materials, you put a telezoom lens on it, and you get something that you don't find in the Bible, but it's very realistic. The prosecution says, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend, for whoever makes himself a king speaks treason against Caesar. Gospel of John. And remember, that's a critical phrase in the trial, because Pilate at that point wilts, remember? Gives in. What they're saying is, if you release this man, Pilate, you will lose your membership in the club. There's a club in Rome called the Amici Caesaris, the Friends of Caesar Club, capital F, capital C. And you got a golden ring with the emperor's image on it, and you never lost your membership in that club except for high treason, at which point, when they pulled the ring off your finger, they sent you into compulsory exile or suicide. So it was a tremendously potent barb that they were making. Well, folks, I better wind it up. Thank you so much for your kind attention. Appreciate it.